Beyond presents spoilers for The Tragedy of Dido, Queen of Carthage by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nash. Discuss. Somewhere else. I really don't care. Today we're looking at Act 2 in detail. Following are some introductory notes, intercut with a rough mix of our recording of the play. The same plain text edit will then follow for those who want to hear the text without interruptions. It was produced at the White Bear Theatre as part of our 2023 Revel season. There will be a better final cut, which will follow this release. As a live recording, there are some minor errors from the heat of the moment. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, you can look for the episode further up the podcast list. Seriously, this is an exercise that some listeners don't enjoy, so if it ain't for you, move on. But if you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land.
Spoiler! Spoiler! Spoiler land!
Troy! Tempest! Content warning, there are lengthy descriptions of war, death, injury detail, war crimes, atrocities, generally. It gets really grim, actually, in the description, so a lot of that's going on. Act 1 was all about plot setup, meeting Aeneas and Venus, and locating the action in Carthage. Act 2 is, arguably, about meeting our title character Dido. And, well, it is up to a point. Yes, we will meet Dido, and the narrative will steer towards her as a central focus, but much of the act is about Aeneas. As Aeneas does story time and moves Dido with his backstory. For those awaiting something active to happen with the plot, come back in Act 3. Now, that isn't a criticism. This isn't a long play, and it takes its time. It's allowed to do that. I said last time, there is a sense of the play sitting back in quite a languid fashion, certainly for the first two acts. But this act is actually quite intense, as Aeneas' story is, as just mentioned, grim as well as gripping. So we left our Trojans separated on the beaches of Carthage. Aeneas thinks he's lost pretty much everyone. But we also met his shipmates, and his fleet has survived, if in a slightly knackered way. We start this act with effectively continued action from the previous. Aeneas had come on, and then he came off, his shipmates came on, and then they came off, and now it's Aeneas' turn again. Act 2, enter Aeneas, Achates, Ascanius, and others. The others continue to just be supernumeraries. And here they see where they are, at the walls of Carthage. And for a guy who recently left the ruined walls of another city, this image is quite triggering.
Where am I now? These should be Carthage walls.
Why stands my sweet Aeneas thus amazed?
My Achates, Theban Niobe, who for her son's death wept out life and breath, and dry with grief was turned into a stone, had not such passions in her head as I. Methinks that town there should be Troy. Yon Ida's hill, there Xanthus' stream, because here's Priamus, and when I know it is not, then I die.
And in this humour is Achates too. I cannot choose but fall upon my knees and kiss his hand. Oh, where is Hecuba? Here she was wont to sit, but saving air is nothing here. And what is this but stone?
Oh, yet this stone doth make Aeneas weep. And would my prayers, as Pygmalion's did, could give it life, that under his conduct we might sail back to Troy and be revenged on these hard-hearted Grecians, which rejoiced that nothing now is left of Priamus. Oh, Priamus is left, and this is he. Come aboard, pursue the hateful Greeks.
What means Aeneas?
What means Aeneas, indeed? We're glad you asked, Achates, because he was getting a little elliptical there. Basically, he's seeing statues round the walls of Carthage, perhaps, as the dead past of Troy. He's seeing Priam, king of Troy, that he isn't dead, that the city isn't lost. It's a fleeting moment that fades.
Achates! Though mine eyes say this is stone, yet thinks my mind that this is Priamus. And when my grieved heart sighs and says no, then would it leap out to give Priam life. Oh, were I not at all, so thou mightst be. Achates, see, King Priam wags his hand. He is alive. Troy is not overcome.
Thy mind, Aeneas, that would have it so, deludes thy eyesight. Priamus is dead.
Troy is sacked and Priamus is dead, and why should poor Aeneas be alive?
Sweet father, leave to weep. This is not he, for were it Priam, he would smile on me.
Aeneas, see, here come the citizens, leave to lament, lest they laugh at our fears.
Aeneas is clearly still very traumatised by the events he has lived through, with his son trying, not necessarily very successfully, to help. Luckily, Achates can pull us back as he sees, well, what he thinks are citizens of Carthage approaching, except it isn't. It's Cloanthus, Segestus, Ilioneus, and others from the last scene. They're all his followers, though he doesn't recognise them yet.
Lords of this town, or whatsoever style belongs unto your name, vouchsafe of ruth to tell us who inhabits this fair town. What kind of people, and who governs them? For we are strangers driven on this shore, and scarcely know within what clime we are.
He might not recognise them, but they do him. It's a big reunion, as the followers of Aeneas in search of a character all bounce off each other. But they don't notice that Aeneas isn't joining in the joy.
I hear Aeneas' voice, but see him not, for none of these can be our general.
Like Ilioneus speaks this nobleman, but Ilioneus goes not in such robes.
You are Achates, or I am deceived.
Aeneas, see, Segestus, or his ghost.
He names Aeneas, let us kiss his feet.
It is our captain, see, Ascanius.
Long live Aeneas and Ascanius.
Achates, speak, for I am overjoyed.
Oh, Ilioneus, art thou yet alive?
Blessed be the time I see Achates' face.
Why turns Aeneas from his trusty friends?
Segestus, Ilioneus and the rest, your sight amazed me.
Aeneas isn't dealing well with emotions right now. He's having these flashbacks. He can't really deal with the return of his mates. I mean, perhaps if you're struggling to deal with a lot of dead friends, having some suddenly come back is actually a bit too much. He composes himself and asks for exposition.
Oh, what destinies have brought my sweet companions in such plight? Oh, tell me, for I long to be resolved.
Lovely Aeneas, these are Carthage walls, and here Queen Dido wears the imperial crown, who for Troy's sake hath entertained us all, and clad us in these wealthy robes we wear. Oft hath she asked us under whom we served, and when we told her she would weep for grief, thinking the sea had swallowed up thy ships, and now she sees thee, how will she rejoice?
See where her servitors pass through the hall, bearing a banquet. Dido is not far.
And our title character enters. A little costume note in that exposition. The lords have, of course, all changed between Act 1 and 2 into wealthy robes. If you don't have a little interval break between Act 1 and Act 2, then it's quite a quick change, but from rags to finery, and so everyone will be in Carthage attire from pretty much this act onwards. You only need to costume Aeneas in, well, not rags, but wet and ragged worn wear. One unified Carthage design aesthetic for most of the costuming, especially from this point onwards, and the Trojans to be different and or really quite knackered. Do they change back for their final exit in the close of the play? Well, we'll see what I think about that later. Enter Dido, Anna, and Diarbus. And train. Choo-choo. Some pomp is needed here. Again, does your train look big in this theatre? And in this first moment, we have to ask a question. Do both Aeneas and Dido kind of fancy each other at this first moment? Because there's some looks going on, but what do they mean?
Look where she comes. Aeneas, view her well.
Well may I view her, but she sees not me.
What stranger art thou that dost eye me thus?
So Aeneas is staring at her, and she does or doesn't like his gaze. A Trojan can look on a queen. How long do these three lines actually take, with the pomp and ceremony and the time it takes to view the queen, music cue, flamboyance. She's a queen. She gets all of the budget. It's a bit male-gazy, specifically Aeneas's gaze. So what are you doing here? Anyway, gaze aside, Aeneas responds with a sense of, I am nothing, whilst generic follower bigs him up.
Sometime I was a Trojan, mighty queen, but Troy is not. What shall I say I am?
Renowned Dido, 'tis our general warlike Aeneas.
Warlike Aeneas? And in these base robes? Go fetch the garment which Sir Caius wear.
Aeneas, he's got a rep, and his clothes are not good enough. Who Sir Caius was, you won't get across to an audience, so I'm not even going to bother talking about it here. But it is interesting that Dido gives him her ex's clothes, so an attendant sort of disappears and grabs them and comes back again from, you know, presumably the back of the wardrobe. How long does this moment take? So it's presumably a robe type thing, so, you know, easy to slip on. But again, it's another moment where something has to happen and there's no dialogue really to cover it. The changing of clothes is an act in drama of changing character. In medieval drama, it denotes the changing of who you are to the world. Sometimes who you are literally with a name change and you become someone else. Marlowe picks up on this theme in Tamburlaine as the shepherd changes into his warrior attire in the first scene, only after he is recognised as a warrior and that his clothing does not match who he really is. Does Dido put this robe on Aeneas? Is it an act Aeneas does, everyone watching, or is it an intimate moment between two high-status figures? Is it a moment of kindness, or is it power play? Dido speaks as this action in theory happens, but it might not. He might just stand there staring at this robe. Dido seems to know he's not himself. She's a good host who makes him at ease. That he might not put on the robe can be played with in the next lines, because now we also play the won't you sit down game.
Brave prince, welcome to Carthage and to me, both happy that Aeneas is our guest. Sit in this chair and banquet with a queen. Aeneas is Aeneas, were he clad in weeds as bad as ever Irus wore.
Doesn't matter the clothing. He is who he is regardless, and so sit by me. Again, is this the beginning of an interest in Aeneas from Dido, or is she just being a good host? Aeneas is reluctant. He's no one now.
This is no seat for one that's comfortless. May it please your grace to let Aeneas wait, for though my birth be great, my fortune's mean, too mean to be companion to a queen.
Thy fortune may be greater than thy birth. Sit down, Aeneas. Sit in Dido's place. And if this be thy son, as I suppose, here let him sit. Be merry, lovely child.
This place beseems me not. Oh, pardon me.
I'll have it so. Aeneas, be content.
Madam, you shall be my mother.
And so I will, sweet child. Be merry, man. Here's to thy better fortune and good stars.
In all humility, I thank your grace.
Ascanius is the key to this moment. In fact, to several moments, important moments in the play, either in of himself or in the changeling of him that will appear in Act 3. How to get Captain Nemo to sit. Dido switches to the child and breaks the mood with a toast. We can infer at this moment that Aeneas sits in Dido's place or next to her, but it could literally be in her throne. I suggest the latter only because in a staging sense that would place him possibly upstage, which is a good commanding place for what is about to come, and then Dido maybe reduces her status to give him the room. Though there are lots of other options here, and, you know, in practical terms, it's probably next to Dido, but it's a staging thought. Everyone else has sat by this point, probably, and they're starting to have, you know, hopefully a merry time. Ha ha. Dido tries to get him to behave to his station. She's a queen, so she knows how important position is. This isn't a good example to make to your followers. Aeneas is, however, far too depressed.
Remember who thou art. Speak like thyself. Humility belongs to common grooms.
And who so miserable as Aeneas is?
Lies it in Dido's hands to make thee blessed? Then be assured thou art not miserable.
Priamus. Oh, Troy. Oh, Hecuba.
In for a penny, in for a pound, Dido decides that the only route out of this is through. Okay? Tell me what happened at Troy. I am trying to construct a Counselor Deanna Troy Next Generation joke here, but I just can't quite make it land. And anyway, what happened at Troy, Aeneas? I've heard conflicted accounts of who betrayed the city. Well, you know, give me an answer. Was it Antenor or Sinon? Aeneas can't give a simple reply. I mean, it's bad shit, man. I've seen some things.
May I entreat thee to discourse at large, and truly too, how Troy was overcome? How many tales go of that city's fall, and scarcely do agree upon one point. Some say Antior did betray the town. Others report was Sinon's perjury. But all in this, that Troy is overcome and Priam dead. Yet how? We hear no news.
A woeful tale bids Dido to unfold, whose memory, like pale death's stony mace, beats forth my senses from this troubled soul and makes Aeneas sink at Dido's feet.
What? Faints Aeneas to remember Troy, in whose defence he fought so valiantly? Look up and speak.
Talking through your troubles is one thing, but clearly this dude isn't ready. If he's fainting from trauma. Anyway, he starts his story. And he starts disassociating himself from the telling. He speaks with Achilles' tongue. Okay, you can overdo a psychological approach to Aeneas and his trauma, but it's not a bad line, actually. So, this is story time. We pick up from a moment which the audience might have been more familiar with than us today. So there may be a bit of a barrier and a storytelling issue here. But that said, there is a good prepping of the moment as he starts to tell the story. He is telling his and our audience to listen to his story. And he issues a content warning. You need to be a hardened warrior to listen to this.
Then speak, Aeneas, with Achilles' tongue. And Dido, and you Carthaginian peers, hear me, but yet with Myrmidon's harsh ears, daily inured to broils and massacres, lest you be moved too much with my sad tale.
And so Aeneas clears up any ambiguity as to who betrayed the Trojans. We leap into the narrative, as the Greek soldiery are all a bit done with the whole war thing. Senior management are obviously a bit worried about this, and call in all the Greek line managers for a company meeting to settle what's happening. Settle in now, for this is a bit of epic storytelling.
The Grecian soldiers, tired with 10 years' war, began to cry, "Let us unto our ships! Troy is invincible! Why stay we here?" At whose outcries Atrides, being appalled, summoned the captains to his princely tent, who, looking on the scars we Trojans gave, seeing the number of their men decreased and the remainder weak and out of heart, gave up their voices to dislodge the camp. And so, in troops, all marched to Tenedos, where, when they came, Ulysses on the sand essayed with honey words to turn them back. And as he spoke, to further his intent, the winds did drive huge billows to the shore, and heaven was darkened with tempestuous clouds. Then he alleged the gods would have them stay, and prophesied Troy should be overcome.
So, Ulysses uses local weather conditions to say the gods don't want us to leave. You may be wondering how Trojan Aeneas knows what happened in the Greek camp. Wonder on. Anyway, in answer to your question, Dido, the traitor who assisted the horse thing was Sinon.
And therewithal, he called false Sinon forth, a man compact of craft and perjury, whose ticing tongue was made of Hermes' pipe, to force 100 watchful eyes to sleep, and him, Epeus, having made the horse, with sacrificing wreaths upon his head, Ulysses sent to our unhappy town. Who, grovelling in the mire of Xanthus' banks, his hands bound at his back, and both his eyes turned up to heaven as one resolved to die, our Phrygian shepherds hailed within the gates, and brought into the court of Priamus, to whom he used actions so pitiful, looks so remorseful, vows so forcible, as therewithal the old man, overcome, kissed him, embraced him, and unloosed his bands, and then...
Aeneas is overcome. This is a memory of hope. At this moment of the narrative, Troy thinks the Greeks have gone. They have a lovely horse, and everything is great. So it's psychologically, it is important to note that this fall from euphoria to despair is what will hurt the most. Dido, who's not exactly being terribly emotionally literate here, goes, "Don't stop, what happens next?"
"Oh, Dido, pardon me."
"Nay, leave not here. Resolve me of the rest."
"Oh, enchanting words of that base slave made him to think a pierced pine tree horse a sacrifice to appease Minerva's wrath. The rather, for that one Lycaon breaking a spear upon his hollow breast was with two winged serpents stung to death."
Bit of classical learning squeezed in there, trimmable if you so choose, or just accept the nature of this section, which is full-throated in the poetic bard front. Anyway, having used a classical reference to allude to what is happening, he now tells us what happened. The horse is brought in a phrasing that suggests they didn't just open the gates, that they actually had to make a hole in the defences. And anyway, everyone has a party.
"Whereat aghast, we were commanded straight with reverence to draw it into Troy, in which unhappy work was I employed. These hands did help to hale it to the gates, through which it could not enter. 'Twas so huge. Oh, had it never entered, Troy had stood. But Priamus, impatient of delay, enforced a wide breach in that rampired wall, which 1,000 battering rams could never pierce, and so came in this fatal instrument, at whose accursed feet, as overjoyed, we banqueted, till, overcome with wine, some surfeited and others soundly slept."
Meanwhile, the traitor Sinon, remember him, sends messages out to the Greeks to come on down and opens up the horse to allow the exit of troops.
"Which, Sinon viewing, caused the Greekish spies to haste to Tenedos and tell the camp. Then he unlocked the horse, and suddenly, from out his entrails, Neoptolemus, setting his spear upon the ground, leapt forth, and after him 1,000 Grecians more, in whose stern faces shined the quenchless fire that after burnt the pride of Asia. By this, the camp was come unto the walls, and through the breach did march into the streets, where, meeting with the rest, 'Kill! Kill!' they cried."
And at this point, the narrative shifts. We go from a report of what happened elsewhere to Aeneas's own experience. He hears the cries of "kill, kill," which wake him. And again, I'm going to pause here to talk about the staging of this. You don't have to do very much with it, if you choose. It is an effective piece of storytelling, and I, as a storyteller, will always champion storytelling as a legitimate staging choice. Having someone stand on stage and tell you a story is fine. If you do, then I suggest the opening of the story is told in a fairly static fashion. Aeneas might be seated for much of it. But then as he enters the story as himself, as he enters the story, and he relives it, then he might become more active, reenacting the narrative. And if you wanted to take that a step further and go for a more maximalist approach, puppetry, shadow puppetry, lights, mimetic stage action in dumb show or similar, and I would suggest that this is the point where you would really go into it. Take the action up a gear. Give Aeneas some on-stage combat as he tells the story. Or, if you really wanted to go for it, have the whole story become a flashback, which the on-stage audience actually literally have to pull him back from, like his vision of Troy and Priam earlier in this act. And those are just the thoughts and suggestions that come to my mind now. I mean, it really is. A sequence like this, which on paper looks like a really long, boring speech, is actually a license to print money. Don't waste it. Anyway, Aeneas is roused from his bed, probably still a bit drunk, by a scene of slaughter. Preparing to enter the fight, he is stopped by the ghost of Hector, who knows better.
Frighted with this confused noise, I rose, and looking from a turret, might behold young infants swimming in their parents' blood. Headless carcasses piled up in heaps, virgins half dead, dragged by their golden hair and with main force, flung on a ring of pikes. Old men with swords thrust through their aged sides, kneeling for mercy to a Greekish lad who, with steel pole axes, dashed out their brains. Then buckled I mine armour, drew my sword, and thinking to go down, came Hector's ghost, with ashy visage, bluish sulphur eyes, his arms torn from his shoulders and his breast furrowed with wounds, and that which made me weep, thongs at his heels, by which Achilles' horse drew him in triumph through the Greekish camp, burst from the earth, crying, Aeneas, fly, Troy is afire, the Grecians have the town!
Oh, Hector, who weeps not to hear his name?
Dido, jumping in there to give Aeneas an in-breath. And if the actor misses these interruption cues, it will completely throw Aeneas, so don't keep it sharp, everyone else, okay? I'm having flashbacks to a production of Look Back in Anger. It's really annoying when the person with one line doesn't give it on time. Anyway, Aeneas doesn't follow Hector's advice and runs into the fight, seeing some atrocities before him, before the enemy figures out who he is.
Yet flung I forth, and desperate of my life, ran in the thickest throngs, and with this sword sent many of their savage ghosts to hell. At last King Pyrrhus fell and full of ire, his harness dropping blood, and on his spear the mangled head of Priam's youngest son, and after him his band of Myrmidons, with balls of wildfire in their murdering paws, which made the funeral flame that burnt fair Troy, all which hemmed me about, crying, this is he!
Oh, how could poor Aeneas escape their hands?
In breath. Having ignored Hector's advice, Aeneas is saved from this situation by Venus, who drags him away from Pyrrhus, only for Aeneas to search out the king and sees Pyrrhus enacting the fall of the royal house in a very brutal fashion.
My mother, Venus, jealous of my health, conveyed me from their crooked nets and bands, so I escaped the furious Pyrrhus' wrath, who then ran to the palace of the king, and at Jove's altar, finding Priamus, about whose withered neck hung Hecuba, folding his hand in hers, and jointly both beating their breasts and falling on the ground. He, with his falchion's point raised up at once, and with Megara's eyes, stared in their face, threatening 1,000 deaths at every glance, to whom the aged king thus, trembling, spoke, Achilles' son, remember what I was, father of 50 sons, but they are slain, lord of my fortune, but my fortune's turned, king of this city, but my Troy is fired, and now I'm neither father, lord, or king. Yet who so wretched but desires to live? Oh, let me live, great Neoptolemus. Not moved at all, but smiling at his tears, this butcher, whilst his hands were yet up, treading on his breast, struck off his hand.
Oh, end, Aeneas, I can hear no more.
To which we might all be crying, Amen, Dido, amen. But Aeneas has started, and he cannot stop. And that's the thing. The trauma is running him now. He cannot stop with the story. And we're in this terribly brutal moment as the king's body is further mutilated and more atrocities just keep on happening.
Which the frantic queen leapt on his face and in his eyelids, hanging by the nails, a little while prolonged her husband's life. At last, the soldiers pulled her by the heels and swung her howling in the empty air, which sent an echo to the wounded king, whereat he lifted up his bedrid limbs and would have grappled with Achilles' son, forgetting both his want of strength and hands, for which he, disdaining, whisked his sword about, and with the wind thereof the king fell down. Then, from the navel to the throat at once, he ripped old Priam, at whose latter gasp Jove's marble statue gan to bend the brow, as loathing Pyrrhus for this wicked act. Yet he, undaunted, took his father's flag and dipped it in the old king's chill-cold blood, and then in triumph ran into the streets, through which he could not pass for slaughtered men. So, leaning on his sword, he stood stone still, viewing the fire wherewith rich Ilion burned.
And with this image, a bloody flag, a butcher leaning on his sword, watching the city burn. Meanwhile, Aeneas finally gets the message and tries to escape with his family. But, environed with Greeks, his wife is killed.
By this, I got my father on my back, this young boy in mine arms, and by the hand led fair Creusa, my beloved wife. When thou, Achates, with thy sword madest way, and we were round environed with the Greeks, oh, there I lost my wife. And had not we fought manfully, I had not told this tale, yet manhood would not serve. Of force we fled.
Of force we fled. Survivor guilt, having been unable to save his wife or other Trojans. If he had fled straight away, would they have all made it? Meanwhile, reaching their ships, they see Cassandra in the distance, but they cannot hope to save her. The daughter of Priam calls to him, and he does try to save her, but Pyrrhus, once again, gets there first.
And as we went unto our ships, thou knowest we saw Cassandra sprawling in the streets, whom Ajax ravished in Diana's fane, her cheeks swollen with sighs, her hair all rent, whom I took up to bear unto our ships, and suddenly the Grecians followed us, and I, alas, was forced to let her lie. Then got we to our ships, and being aboard, Polyxena cried out, Aeneas, stay, the Greeks pursue me, stay and take me in. Moved with her voice, I leapt into the sea, thinking to bear her on my back aboard, for all our ships were launched into the deep, and as I swum, she standing on the shore was by the cruel Myrmidons surprised, and after that by Pyrrhus sacrificed.
The audience is gripped with a host of questions about the action, but Aeneas is finally spent, and Achates, whose own trauma no one seems to care about, fills in the remaining details that they know.
I die with melting ruth, Aeneas, leave.
Oh, what became of aged Hecuba?
How got Aeneas to the fleet again?
But how scaped Helen, she that caused this war?
Achates, speak, sorrow hath tired me quite.
What happened to the queen we cannot show. We hear they led her captive into Greece. As for Aeneas, he swam quickly back. And Helena betrayed Deiphobus, her lover, after Alexander died, and so was reconciled to Menelaus.
Oh, had that ticing strumpet ne'er been born. Trojan, thy rueful tale hath made me sad. Come, let us think upon some pleasing sport to rid me from these melancholy thoughts.
And with that, the scene abruptly ends. Achates doesn't know all the answers. The fog of war means that there is only rumour. Helen of Troy is dismissed and blamed by Dido, who rather belatedly turns the subject matter to something more cheerful, and everyone exits. This shouldn't be just an exit. You need to work this exit. Music and carefully thought-out action. Aeneas is a wreck. I mean, but also, how about his men? They've all been through similar experiences. How do the Carthaginians help them? Does Dido lead them off? What is the order of their exit? Take some time to make this work, because everyone exits except Ascanius, whose father and everyone else in Loco Parentis has forgotten about. But, here enters Venus with Cupid at another door, and takes Ascanius by the sleeve. Now, remember last episode when I pointed out that we need to think carefully about how we demonstrate the arrival of gods? Well, here we have it again. Venus, we've met, so, okay, you'll kind of know it's the gods because it's a god you've already met, and we'll come to Cupid anon. But there's something very creepy about what happens here. Offering sweets to a child. Bit of stranger danger going on.
Fair child, stay thou with Dido's waiting maid. I'll give thee sugared almonds, sweet conserves, a silver girdle and a golden purse, and
This young prince shall be thy playfellow.
Are you Queen Dido's son?
Aye, and my mother gave me this fine bow.
Shall I have such a quiver and a bow?
Such bow, such quiver, and such golden shafts will Dido give to sweet Ascanius. For Dido's sake, I take thee in my arms and stick these spangled feathers in thy hat. Eat comforts in my arms, and I will sing.
Okay, so we fudged the singing in our production. The text doesn't give us music or lyrics, so you would need to create a song. Or do what we did and just use a few notes to suggest that the song is a sleeping charm and the child doesn't hear it because it falls asleep straight away. Or, hell, they just drugged the comfits. You know, it's entirely possible. Either way, it's still really creepy. Because Venus's plan is to substitute Cupid as a changeling so that Cupid can get close to Dido and hit her with the love arrow.
Ah, now is he fast asleep. And in his grove, amongst green brakes, I'll lay Ascanius and strew him with sweet-smelling violets, blushing roses, purple hyacinth. These milk-white doves shall be his sentinels, who, if that any seek to do him hurt, will quickly fly to Kithaeria's fist. Now, Cupid, turn thee to Ascanius' shape, and go to Dido, who, instead of him, will set thee on her lap and play with thee. Then, touch her white breast with this arrowhead, that she may dote upon Aeneas' love. And by that means repair his broken ships, victual his soldiers, give him wealthy gifts, and he, at last, depart to Italy, or else in Carthage make his kingly throne.
I will, fair mother, and so play my part, as every touch shall wound Queen Dido's heart.
Exit Cupid, which is helpful, as he enters in the opening of the next act in 6 lines time.
Sleep, my sweet nephew, in these cooling shades, free from the murmur of these running streams, the cry of beasts, the rattling of the winds, or whisking of these leaves, all shall be still. And nothing interrupt thy quiet sleep till I return and take thee hence again.
Exit Venus and Ascanius. So, I mean, I suppose they are family, but the gods are happy to drug and kidnap a child, replace the child with a childlike god who will make Dido fall in love with Aeneas so that she will repair his ships. Which is a somewhat complicated and creepy plan. Have they just thought about asking nicely? Now, how do you portray Cupid? Because he doesn't have to literally look like Ascanius. And you can use the disconnect quite effectively. In the original staging, 2 boys of similar appearance would probably have been used. And so, after 2 acts, the scene is set, the characters have met, the world is built, and now the plot can actually get going. And once it gets going, it does not let up. Next time we will see this Cupid gambit come together and also get some character development for the largely silent, if present, Anna and Iarbas. And that's it from this spoilers episode for Act 2 of Dido. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the text, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I am more importantly in plain error about something, let me know. I might re-edit based on your thoughts, or not. In a moment you will hear the rough cut, plain text uninterrupted, but if you'd like more on this play, there are exploring sessions galore on the YouTube, links in the show description. The full cast audio adaptation edit of this will follow soon, so keep an ear out. The recording used throughout this episode is a live mix of the performed play. It's a rough mix and focuses on the text as writ, so the final release will be cleaner and a more entertaining listen, but also may have some cuts. In the version used throughout this recording, the cast was as follows. Sojourner Hazelwood Connell was Dido, Kit Maguire, Aeneas, Karim Cromfley, Iarbus, Alex Capilla, Anna, Pamela Flanagan, Ascanius, Lindsay Beecham, Ilioneus, Sarah Blake, Venus, Keith Hill, Achates, Alexandra Katagida, Cloanthus, Emma Kemp, Cupid, Simon Nader, Suggestus. You will also just about be able to still hear in the edit the music performed live by Rule Fox. We will be trying to reincorporate that into the final edit further down the line. The technical operator for the live show was Valentina Vinci, and the producer was myself, Robert Crichton. And now I leave you with the rough cut of Act Two of Dido, Queen of Carthage by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nash. Enjoy.
Where am I now? These should be Carthage walls.
Why stands my sweet Aeneas thus amazed?
My Achates, Theban Niobe, who for her son's death wept out life and breath, and dry with grief was turned into a stone, had not such passions in her head as I. Methinks that town there should be Troy. Yon Ida's hill, there Xanthus' stream, because here's Priamus, and when I know it is not, then I die.
And in this humour is Achates too. I cannot choose but fall upon my knees and kiss his hand. Oh, where is Hecuba? Here she was wont to sit, but saving air is nothing here. And what is this but stone?
Oh, yet this stone doth make Aeneas weep. And would my prayers, as Pygmalion's did, could give it life, that under his conduct we might sail back to Troy and be revenged on these hard-hearted Grecians, which rejoiced that nothing now is left of Priamus. Oh, Priamus is left, and this is he. Come, come aboard, pursue the hateful Greeks.
What means Aeneas?
Achates, though mine eyes say this is stone, yet thinks my mind that this is Priamus. And when my grieved heart sighs and says no, then would it leap out to give Priam life. Oh, were I not at all, so thou mightst be. Achates, see, King Priam wags his hand. He is alive. Troy is not overcome.
Thy mind, Aeneas, that would have it so, deludes thy eyesight. Priamus is dead.
Oh, Troy is sacked, and Priamus is dead, and why should poor Aeneas be alive?
Sweet father, leave to weep. This is not he, for were it Priam, he would smile on me.
Aeneas, see, here come the citizens, leave to lament, lest they laugh at our fears.
Lords of this town, or whatsoever style belongs unto your name, vouchsafe of ruth to tell us who inhabits this fair town. What kind of people, and who governs them? For we are strangers driven on this shore, and scarcely know within what clime we are.
I hear Aeneas' voice, but see him not, for none of these can be our general.
Like Ilioneus speaks this nobleman, but Ilioneus goes not in such robes.
You are Achates, or I am deceived.
Aeneas, see, Suggestus, or his ghost.
He names Aeneas, let us kiss his feet.
It is our captain, see, Ascanius.
Long live Aeneas and Ascanius.
Achates, speak, for I am overjoyed.
Oh, Ilioneus, art thou yet alive?
Blessed be the time I see Achates' face.
Why turns Aeneas from his trusty friends?
Suggestus, Ilioneus and the rest, your sight amazed me. Oh, what destinies have brought my sweet companions in such plight? Oh, tell me, for I long to be resolved.
Lovely Aeneas, these are Carthage walls, and here Queen Dido wears the imperial crown, who for Troy's sake hath entertained us all and clad us in these wealthy robes we wear. Oft hath she asked us under whom we served, and when we told her she would weep for grief, thinking the sea had swallowed up thy ships, and now she sees thee, how will she rejoice?
See where her servitors pass through the hall, bearing a banquet. Dido is not far.
Look where she comes. Aeneas, view her well.
Well may I view her, but she sees not me.
What stranger art thou that dost eye me thus?
Sometime I was a Trojan, mighty queen, but Troy is not. What shall I say I am?
Renowned Dido, 'tis our general warlike Aeneas.
Warlike Aeneas? And in these base robes? Go fetch the garment which Sychaeus wear. Brave prince, welcome to Carthage and to me. Both happy that Aeneas is our guest. Sit in this chair and banquet with a queen. Aeneas is Aeneas, were he clad in weeds as bad as ever Irus wore.
This is no seat for one that's comfortless. May it please your grace to let Aeneas wait, for though my birth be great, my fortune's mean, too mean to be companion to a queen.
Thy fortune may be greater than thy birth. Sit down, Aeneas. Sit in Dido's place. And if this be thy son, as I suppose, here let him sit. Be merry, lovely child.
This place beseems me not. Oh, pardon me.
I'll have it so. Aeneas, be content.
Madam, you shall be my mother.
And so I will, sweet child. Be merry, man. Here's to thy better fortune and good stars.
In all humility, I thank your grace.
Remember who thou art. Speak like thyself. Humility belongs to common grooms.
And who so miserable as Aeneas is?
Lies it in Dido's hands to make thee blessed? Then be assured thou art not miserable.
Priamus, O Troy, O Hecuba!
May I entreat thee to discourse at large, and truly too, how Troy was overcome, how many tales go of that city's fall, and scarcely do agree upon one point. Some say Antior did betray the town, others report was Sinian's perjury. But all in this, that Troy is overcome and Priam dead. Yet how? We hear no news.
A woeful tale bids Dido to unfold, whose memory, like pale death's stony mace, beats forth my senses from this troubled soul and makes Aeneas sink at Dido's feet.
What? Faints Aeneas to remember Troy, in whose defence he fought so valiantly? Look up and speak.
Then speak, Aeneas, with Achilles' tongue. And Dido, and you Carthaginian peers, hear me, but yet with Myrmidon's harsh ears, daily inured to broils and massacres, lest you be moved too much with my sad tale. The Grecian soldiers, tired with 10 years' war, began to cry, "Let us unto our ships, Troy is invincible. Why stay we here?" At whose outcries Atrides, being appalled, summoned the captains to his princely tent, who, looking on the scars we Trojans gave, seeing the number of their men decreased and the remainder weak and out of heart, gave up their voices to dislodge the camp. And so, in troops, all marched to Tenedos, where, when they came, Ulysses on the sand essayed with honey words to turn them back. And as he spoke, to further his intent, the winds did drive huge billows to the shore, and heaven was darkened with tempestuous clouds. Then he alleged the gods would have them stay, and prophesied Troy should be overcome. And therewithal he called false Sinon forth, a man compact of craft and perjury, whose ticing tongue was made of Hermes' pipe, to force 100 watchful eyes to sleep, and him, Epeus having made the horse, with sacrificing wreaths upon his head, Ulysses sent to our unhappy town, who, grovelling in the mire of Xanthus' banks, his hands bound at his back, and both his eyes turned up to heaven as one resolved to die, our Phrygian shepherds hailed within the gates, and brought into the court of Priamus, to whom he used actions so pitiful, looks so remorseful, vows so forcible, as therewithal the old man, overcome, kissed him, embraced him, and unloosed his bands, and then... Oh, Dido, pardon me.
Nay, leave not here. Resolve me of the rest.
The enchanting words of that base slave made him to think a pierced pine tree horse a sacrifice to appease Minerva's wrath. The rather, for that one Lycoan breaking a spear upon his hollow breast, was with 2 winged serpents stung to death, whereat, aghast, we were commanded straight with reverence to draw it into Troy, in which unhappy work was I employed. These hands did help to hale it to the gates, through which it could not enter, 'twas so huge. Oh, had it never entered, Troy had stood. But Priamus, impatient of delay, enforced a wide breach in that rampired wall, which 1,000 battering rams could never pierce, and so came in this fatal instrument. at whose accursed feet, as overjoyed, we banqueted, till overcome with wine, some surfeited and others soundly slept. Which, sign in viewing, caused the Greekish spies to haste to Tenedos and tell the camp. Then he unlocked the horse, and suddenly, from out his entrails, Neoptolemus, setting his spear upon the ground, leapt forth, and after him 1,000 Grecians more, in whose stern faces shined the quenchless fire that after burnt the pride of Asia. By this, the camp was come unto the walls, and through the breach did march into the streets, where, meeting with the rest, "Kill! Kill!" they cried. Frighted with this confused noise, I rose, and looking from a turret, might behold young infants swimming in their parents' blood, headless carcasses piled up in heaps, virgins half dead, dragged by their golden hair and with main force, flung on a ring of pikes, old men with swords thrust through their aged sides, kneeling for mercy to a Greekish lad who, with steel pole axes, dashed out their brains. Then buckled I mine armor, drew my sword, and thinking to go down, came Hector's ghost, with ashy visage, bluish sulphur eyes, his arms torn from his shoulders and his breast furrowed with wounds, and that which made me weep, thongs at his heels, by which Achilles' horse drew him in triumph through the Greekish camp, burst from the earth, crying, "Aeneas, fly! Troy is afire! The Grecians have the town!"
Oh, Hector, who weeps not to hear his name?
Yet flung I forth, and desperate of my life, ran in the thickest throngs, and with this sword sent many of their savage ghosts to hell. At last King Pyrrhus fell, and full of ire, his harness dropping blood, and on his spear the mangled head of Priam's youngest son, and after him his band of Myrmidons, with balls of wildfire in their murdering paws, which made the funeral flame that burnt fair Troy, all which hemmed me about, crying, "This is he!"
Oh, how could poor Aeneas escape their hands?
My mother, Venus, jealous of my health, conveyed me from their crooked nets and bands, so I escaped the furious Pyrrhus' wrath, who then ran to the palace of the king, and at Jove's altar, finding Priamus, about whose withered neck hung Hecuba, folding his hand in hers, and jointly both beating their breasts and falling on the ground. He, with his falchion's point, raised up at once, and with Megara's eyes, stared in their face, threatening 1,000 deaths at every glance, to whom the aged king thus, trembling, spoke, "Achilles' son, remember what I was, father of 50 sons, but they are slain, lord of my fortune, but my fortune's turned, king of this city, but my Troy is fired, and now I'm neither father, lord, or king. Yet who so wretched but desires to live? Oh, let me live, great Neoptolemus!" Not moved at all, but smiling at his tears, this butcher, whilst his hands were yet up, treading on his breast, struck off his hand.
Oh, end, Aeneas, I can hear no more.
At which the frantic queen leapt on his face, and in his eyelids, hanging by the nails, a little while prolonged her husband's life. At last the soldiers pulled her by the heels and swung her howling in the empty air, which sent an echo to the wounded king, whereat he lifted up his bedrid limbs and would have grappled with Achilles' son, forgetting both his want of strength and hands, for which he disdaining whisked his sword about, and with the wind thereof the king fell down. Then from the navel to the throat at once he ripped old Priam, at whose latter gasp Jove's marble statue gan to bend the brow, as loathing Pyrrhus for this wicked act. Yet he, undaunted, took his father's flag and dipped it in the old king's chill-cold blood, and then in triumph ran into the streets, through which he could not pass for slaughtered men. So, leaning on his sword, he stood stone still, viewing the fire wherewith rich Ilion burned. By this I got my father on my back, this young boy in mine arms, and by the hand led fair Creusa, my beloved wife, when thou, Achates, with thy sword madest way, and we were round environed with the Greeks. Oh, there I lost my wife. And had not we fought manfully, I had not told this tale, yet manhood would not serve. Of force we fled, and as we went unto our ships, thou knowest we saw Cassandra sprawling in the streets, whom Ajax ravished in Diana's fane, her cheeks swollen with sighs, her hair all rent, whom I took up to bear unto our ships, and suddenly the Grecians followed us, and I, alas, was forced to let her lie. Then got we to our ships, and being aboard, Polyxena cried out, "Aeneas, stay! The Greeks pursue me, stay and take me in!" Moved with her voice, I leapt into the sea, thinking to bear her on my back aboard, for all our ships were launched into the deep, and as I swum, she standing on the shore was by the cruel Myrmidons surprised, and after that by Pyrrhus sacrificed.
I die with melting ruth, Aeneas, leave!
Oh, what became of aged Hecuba?
How got Aeneas to the fleet again?
But how escaped Helen, she that caused this war?
Achates, speak, sorrow hath tired me quite.
What happened to the queen we cannot show. We hear they led her captive into Greece. As for Aeneas, he swam quickly back. And Helena betrayed Deiphobus, her lover, after Alexander died, and so was reconciled to Menelaus.
Oh, had that ticing strumpet ne'er been born! Trojan, thy rueful tale hath made me sad. Come, let us think upon some pleasing sport to rid me from these melancholy thoughts.
Fair child, stay thou with Dido's waiting maid. I'll give thee sugared almonds, sweet conserves, a silver girdle and a golden purse, and this young prince shall be thy playfellow.
Are you Queen Dido's son?
Aye, and my mother gave me this fine bow.
Shall I have such a quiver and a bow?
Such bow, such quiver, and such golden shafts will Dido give to sweet Ascanius. For Dido's sake, I take thee in my arms and stick these spangled feathers in thy hat. Eat comforts in my arms, and I will sing. Ah, now is he fast asleep, and in his grove, amongst green brakes, I'll lay Ascanius and strew him with sweet-smelling violets, blushing roses, purple hyacinth. These milk-white doves shall be his sentinels, who, if that any seek to do him hurt, will quickly fly to Kithaeria's fist. Now, Cupid, turn thee to Ascanius' shape. And go to Dido, who, instead of him, will set thee on her lap and play with thee. Then touch her white breast with this arrowhead, that she may dote upon Aeneas' love, and by that means repair his broken ships, victual his soldiers, give him wealthy gifts, and he, at last, depart to Italy, or else in Carthage make his kingly throne.
I will, fair mother. And so play my part, as every touch shall wound Queen Dido's heart.
Sleep, my sweet nephew, in these cooling shades, free from the murmur of these running streams, the cry of beasts, the rattling of the winds, or whisking of these leaves, all shall be still. And nothing interrupt thy quiet sleep, till I return and take thee hence again.
This spoilers episode was hosted and produced by myself, Robert Crichton, for the Beyond podcast. Follow us on social media at Beyond Shakes. Visit our website at beyondshakespeare.org or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Patrons get to choose the plays we work on next. So the more you give, the more you can basically bribe us into doing what you want. But for now, goodbye.